Well, that could not be anybody else in the whole world but Benny Bell. And that says something, too, because if you figure all these interchangeable pop singers that we have now, and even perhaps in the back in the 40s and 50s when you would get these crooners and lounge singers, and they were different in ways, but also a lot of them kind of the same. You'd hear them in the barbershop or wherever, and then you'd say, oh, is that Al Martino, or is that Dean Martin, or is it Vic Damone? Yeah. I mean, not to take away from those people. But when you hear a Benny Bell song, except for Shaving Cream, which was not sung by Benny Bell, we'll get to that, you know that it's a Benny Bell song. Benny Bell, born Benjamin Samberg, Benny was a novelty writer and singer, also something out of the klezmer and Jewish comedy tradition as well. And he was a born, dyed-in-the-wool entertainer all his life. Did he have as much success as he wanted? No. Or as much success as he deserved? No. And he was partially responsible for that just by his own stubborn nature, I guess. But he did leave a legacy of dozens and dozens and dozens of songs, the best known of which is Shaving Cream, of course, made popular again in the 1970s thanks to Dr. Demento, and hopefully not only Shaving Cream, but many more of Bell's songs will finally go out there more and become part of America's musical legacy and not stay so hidden. Things will be more on CDs and more on iTunes. That'll take some work, and I'm hoping it'll get done. And if there's a person who'll do that and who will keep the flame and promote the legacy of Benny Bell, it's the guy who's on the phone with us right now. His name is Joel Samberg. He is Benny Bell's biographer and also Benny Bell's grandson. So, Joel, welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely a pleasure. So, first question, when did you decide that it was time to write the story of your grandfather?
When I was 1.5 years old.
Okay.
I long had wanted to write something about him ever since I was a kid, because even then, two things came into play. One, I've always known that I wanted to be a writer. And two, since I didn't live with him, but I saw him a lot, I always knew he was a fascinating guy. So you put those two things together. I mean, nearly everything that I saw or heard or experienced, I wanted to turn, at least in my head at the time, into a book, a play, a novel, a movie, whatever. So he was a great subject for that. That said, He was a very paranoid guy in a lot of ways, and he thought that because he had some success along the way, some people might, and some of that success was pretty substantial, at least in the New York metropolitan area, he thought that other people would think he was rich and famous. And because some people might think he was rich and famous, they might, in his mind, come and try to, kidnap me and my sister for ransom or something like that. The bottom line of all that was that he never really wanted anybody to write anything that would associate Benny Bell, his stage name, with the Samberg family name. And sometimes he would actually come out and say that, especially if I would write a little piece about him that would be published in, maybe my college newspaper or something like that. So I got the sense, well, I better stay away from this. Now, it's not that I waited for him to pass. It's just that I went ahead and lived my life, went into some certain directions in journalism and communications and public relations and raised a family, and I just didn't really get around to it. Then after he did pass, which was in 1999, I realized, I never got to do that before. I got a little resistance before. Well, maybe I can do it now, and I won't have that kind of resistance now. So I went ahead and started to formulate the plans a couple of years ago.
So he would have been over 100 now.
He was born in 1906. He would have been 105 now. We lost him 12 years ago in 1999.
Wow.
When he was 93, I think.
What is the Bell story? Was he born in New York, or was he an immigrant?
No, he was born here in New York City, in Manhattan. his parents came from Poland or Russia. The border changed quite frequently back then. But he was born here. He didn't speak English until he went to school because his parents spoke Yiddish. But he grew up on the streets of the Lower East Side, which is where a lot of his characters and a lot of his ideas sprung from. As a matter of fact, before he went into the whole novelty thing, which I'm sure you'll probably ask me about soon, he spent quite a number of years trying to break through as a songwriter and recording artist with songs that almost exclusively had to do with being poor and being a bum and being a pushcart peddler and being a hobo. A lot of his work, not just his songs, but he even wrote some little pamphlets and books that had to do with hobos and bums. And those were the people that he saw on the street in front of his apartment, or apartments, plural, as the case may be, since they moved around a lot. And that was his persona.
Huh. And was there also, I read somewhere that there had been some idea of him doing something rabbinical or cantor. I can't imagine him as a cantor, but...
father was a part-time cantor. He was a real cantor, but there were a lot of cantors in the Jewish cantor in the Lower East Side and all through New York. And I suppose, I don't know precisely the story, but I suppose that he couldn't find a spot as a full-time cantor, so his father also owned little grocery stores, but would be called upon to loan his cantorial talents from one synagogue to another from time to time. And he wanted young Ben to become a cantor, a full-time cantor, a real, honest-to-God, every day of the week cantor. But Ben, as readers of the book will find out, did not want to go in that direction.
By the way, we should mention that the title of the book is Grandpa Had a Long One, which is published by Bear Manor Media and available everywhere?
Yes, it's available from the publisher. It's available on Amazon.com. It's even on Kindle now. It can be found almost anywhere.
On Kindle, too. That's amazing. So is there somewhere in the book where it says what his first novelty song was, or is that impossible to determine?
His first novelty song is different from his first song. I don't really recall which novelty song was the absolute first. I know that the first one that broke through as a jukebox hit was, let me think, was, I believe, Take a Ship for Yourself?
That's S-H-I-P. Yeah, Take a Ship for Yourself. I didn't realize it was that early. Let me see if I have that one.
Yeah, those were all in the mid-40s. Again, as readers of the book will find out, he was struggling along before that without much success. Well, I shouldn't say without much success. He had a lot of Yiddish songs, a lot of Yiddish comedy, and a lot of radio broadcasts before the novelty stuff took off in the mid-40s. But basically, since he wanted to devote his entire life and make a living doing this, I guess you can say that he was struggling along, financially and otherwise. A record executive, I believe it's at RCA, who was a casual friend of his, said, "You know, Ben, you know the jukebox market, which was just kicking off back then?" Uh-huh. Ben said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, you know what? I think that if you do some risque songs, those are going to take off because people listen to those in bars and saloons. They don't listen to it at home where the parents can get in the way and make them stop. So why don't you write a few of those and peddle it to the jukebox operators all through the city and see what happens?" Well, Ben did that, and that's what took off.
Benny Bell, Go Take a Ship for Yourself. One of the very first, not one of his first songs, but really one of the first that took off as a novelty hit, and took him, I guess, from the Mickey Katz kind of Yiddishkeit comedy and klezmer numbers that he was doing into something more secular and then just a little bit more naughty.
Correct.
And I'm curious, so it's interesting that the naughtier stuff would sell better, even though the kids who would listen to it on the jukeboxes couldn't really bring it home. Or maybe they could. They could just hide the record and play it when mom and dad are out or something like that.
Yeah, and he was in charge of his own little... He was one of the first true independent artists. He was an entrepreneur in every sense of the word. So in addition to delivering records to jukebox operators, he would also press a bunch and try to sell it to record stores based on the popularity it would achieve from jukebox play. And it wasn't just, I don't think it was really little kids. I think it was older teenagers who would be the ones know, and young people in their very early 20s who would be the ones who would be allowed to go to these bars and saloons. Kids wouldn't have heard it on a jukebox necessarily, unless it was in a little candy store, and I'm not sure about that even, because even though they seem pretty tame, the authorities back then were looking for this sort of thing. It was a different world.
Did he ever get into trouble?
Almost. He, it's so cinematic when you tell the story, because I think somebody, and maybe me, if I had somebody to support me doing it, should write a movie or a play about his life. He didn't actually get arrested for anything, but somebody tipped him off that they were coming to look for him when one of the other songs started to become popular. Maybe it was Everybody Wants My Fanny, or maybe it was what was euphemistically called the automobile song, which was a tactic of his to use a title that wasn't naughty, but once you start to listen to the lyrics, you get to realize what was going on. So somebody tipped him off, and he, I don't really remember what he did, but he did something to divert them away from him, and he didn't get in trouble that time. And then there were other times when he was warned by the authorities themselves, not from somebody who tipped them off, who said to him, "Hey, you better cool it a little bit, or else you're going to get in trouble."
Huh? And I guess he didn't. or maybe he did for like a week.
That's up for debate, whether he did or didn't. He was nowhere near as naughty as he probably could have been, as I know he could have been, and as I just alluded to, he did pick titles very often that were not risque, and that was probably a good tactic too, because it's sort of like a little trick, a little tease. As a matter of fact, the title of the book, which you were kind enough to mention, Grandpa Had a Long One,
is
several meanings to that. Number one, Grandpa had a long career and he had a long life, so there's that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a song which while I was growing up, I heard him refer to as Grandpa Had a Long One. If you read the lyrics, that line is in it all the time, but the official title that he picked, or maybe it was the unofficial title that he used, was Noses, or Noses Run in My Family.
Oh, we just played that before we came into this segment.
On the labels and in a lot of his own ledgers and diaries and stuff like that, he calls it Noses or Noses Run in My Family, but I heard him call it Grandpa Had a Long One. The point being, had it been called Grandpa Had a Long One in the 40s when it came out, that might have been one of the ones to get him in trouble. But because it was called Noses, it sort of diverted that kind of those kind of problems right off the bat.
Now, was it tougher for him in the late 50s and into the 1960s when restrictions were loosening up and suddenly you had comedians doing these party records, and did that push him sort of out of style because he was tamer than Bell Barth and Red Fox and folks like that?
I don't necessarily think that it was because he was tamer. I think it was because he didn't have good business guidance. He probably could have continued on an upward track in terms of popularity and influence and income had he had a manager, a business manager, an agent, a real record company behind him instead of his own, which was Madison Records, which was his own little one-man company.
Right. But why, in other words, what was he lacking? Did he lack the distribution? Why would it have been different had he had business sense?
Because I think he would have had some people with a lot of knowledge about where to market the stuff, how to market the stuff, how to advertise. They would have been able to get him tours, but he handled everything himself, and he didn't know any of that stuff. And the reason he handled it himself is not because he couldn't have found an agent, not because he couldn't have found a manager or even a record company, but because he didn't want to. He was so set on doing everything his way, that, and also, readers of the book will find out that he was burned very early in his career by record companies and publishers. There was money that he was owed that he was never paid, and there were fake contracts that he signed that really screwed him up for a while. So he was very bitter because of the way he was treated as a young professional songwriter and entertainer. And that's another reason that he became very distrustful of the industry. He didn't like the industry. He liked the art. He liked the music. Yeah. He loved to make people laugh, but he hated the business of show business. That's why he didn't have a record company or an agent or a manager. Not because he couldn't get one, but because he didn't want one.
He chose not to. And, you know, at a certain point in the 50s and 60s, it must have been tougher times. Things passed him by a little bit. And, I mean, he still scraped together, I guess, a living from... I mean, lots of, actually, performers now make their money performing live and doing tours, and that's where they make their real dough, rather than record sales. How did he scrape a living together when times were tough?
That's why I call him the most amazing entertainer ever to exist, because he did spend his life doing this. He did scrape together a living doing this. It was not a big one. As my late father would attest to, because my father grew up in poverty because of that. But that's what he did. I would say for about 90% of his adult life, my grandfather was make his living through music in one way or another, and he would subsidize that with tiny little jobs here and there, a messenger for a while, a pushcart peddler for a while, an administrative assistant for a while, little things, but they never lasted more than a few weeks or a few months at most, because his mind was elsewhere, as you might imagine.
Of course. We're talking to Joel Sandberg about Benny Bell, Joel's grandfather, and we're getting up to the point now where it's into the 1970s. Bell is still plugging along in his way, and then magic happens, in a manner of speaking. Why don't you tell that story?
You're talking about shaving cream.
Of course.
Okay. As you alluded to early in this conversation, there is a version of shaving cream with which most people are familiar that does not have Benny Bell's voice on it. That is part of the whole... that was whole part of the I don't want to get in trouble section of his life. He was plugging along there with quite a number of novelty, risque type of songs, and then, as we talked about before, there was a little bit of a concern with the authorities and stuff, but he poured ahead, he forged ahead writing a couple of them, and he wrote this song called Shaving Cream, which substitutes a four-letter expletive with the phrase shaving cream.
Uh-huh.
And it's just very infectiously funny and silly and goofy, and it's not going to, you know, help the world, but it's going to make it a little easier to live in. But he also knew that he was teetering on the brink of getting in trouble. So he asked a friend of his, who didn't have any other novelty songs out there, who the industry did not know, who the authorities did not know, to record the song. And his friend recorded the song. My grandfather was in charge of the entire production. Obviously, he wrote it, but he also arranged it and produced it and marketed it and did everything. Then, that was the record that Dr. Demento in the early 70s found in some record store somewhere, played it on his fledgling new show, his novelty show, the Dr. Demento Show, and it was really the first song that helped Dr. Demento become Dr. Demento.
Yeah.
And because it was it didn't say Benny Bell on there, there was a little bit of a lag time until Dr. Demento discovered who was responsible for it.
Right, because the label says Paul Wynn. And that
Paul
was a pseudonym too, wasn't it? Paul Wynn was actually...
Well, Paul Wynn, there's a funny story about that. There really is no Paul Wynn. There was... Paul Wynn was a name that even my grandfather used from time to time as a pseudonym when he didn't want to use either Benny Sandberg or Benny Bell. So when he got this friend who had a completely different name entirely, when he was recording Shaving Cream, my grandfather said, hey, you're going to use this name, Paul Wynn. That way, my grandfather wouldn't get in trouble as Benny Sandberg or Benny Bell, and his friend, whose name was Percy, wouldn't get in trouble either, because there is no Paul Wynn. So that's the way it happened, and Dr. Demento did some research and found out that this guy named Benny Bell was responsible not only for Shaving Cream, but all these other great novelty songs from the 1940s. To promote the Dr. Demento show, which was carried for a time on WABC in New York. WABC ran promos for the show, and one of the ways they ran promos was by playing shaving cream. My grandfather was in New York, of course. He was living in Brooklyn, and he heard it, and from there, everything just exploded into mass hysteria, popularity.
Was it that big? It really got that... I mean, I know I was part of the Dr. Demento cult, but I didn't know how big it got outside of dimensions and dementites like me. Was it huge?
Yes, well, shaving cream actually hit, I think it was number 17 on the Billboard charts.
Good
that
Lord.
Year, 1975. So that became a commercial hit outside of the demented universe.
And how old... I'm sorry, but one thing I'm still not clear on, how old was the song, was the recording? Was it fairly recent, or was that a Bell recording from the 40s? Or a Wing recording from the 40s?
Yeah, the one that was heard on Demento and WABC and then many, many other stations across the country
the
from 1975
one.
On was the original recording from 1946.
From 46, okay. I mean, I know Bell ended up doing other versions and recording it and doing more verses and stuff, but let's hear the famous one that is from 1946. One thing I wanted to ask is, he seemed to use the same band for many, many years. It has a very particular sound. Were they all friends of his, or just, you know, he always got that same group of musicians together, it sounds like?
For a vast majority of the novelty recordings, yes, there was a group of friends. They, you know, changed members here and there, and sometimes some would be able to come to his little recording sessions in his basement, and sometimes somebody else would have to substitute because some of them weren't professional musicians. Some of them were professional musicians who just kept it quiet so that they wouldn't have to tell their union about it, because it was all non-union work in a very unionized industry. But I think what is more key to that sort of observation is the fact that he arranged everything, and his arrangements were very similar. So even if the musicians were different, it would still sound somewhat similar.
You have that low clarinet, the... what else? It's piano in there, and...
There was usually a clarinet, a saxophone, a trumpet, a piano, a drum, and that was really about it. A couple others here and there. And there were some recordings that had fuller orchestras. I mean, there were some where I actually would be quite amazed to hear the quality of not only the arrangement but also the productions. There were a few that were really, really good, which proves to me that he was a very, very talented guy that just never really hit the stride that he should have.
Well, at least he did for a brief time in 1975, albeit almost 30 years later. But here's the Benny Bell song, sung by Percy, I forget what the last name is.
Weinstein.
Percy Weinstein, a.k.a. Paul Wynn, with everybody sing along. It's the one and only Shaving Cream. Benny Bell, of course. Well, actually, Benny Bell, the wordsmith and the arranger of Shaving Cream, sung by Percy Weinstein, a.k.a. Paul Wynn. You're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio. It's 11:27 in the morning on this Saturday, January 15th, 2011, and we are talking with the grandson of the author of that song, the grandson of Benny Bell. His name is Joel Samberg, and he's telling us about Bell's life and career, because he wrote a book about it. The book is called Grandpa Had a Long One, available everywhere, even on Kindle, but mainly from Bear Manor Media, where you can you also pick up your other book, Real Jewish? Is that Bear Manor as well?
No, Real Jewish was Jonathan David Publishers, a separate publisher in New York City, but that also can be found on Amazon.
Okay. Real Jewish, and just very quickly, that book is about what?
That book, Real Jewish, which is R-E-E-L, as in a movie reel, is the subtitle, Real Jewish, A Century of Jewish Movies. It came out in 2000, so the century we're talking about, of course, is the 20th century. And it is a listing and a conversation, really, about several dozen movies that some people would like to call Jewish movies. And the way we came to define Jewish movies is any movie who has a main character whose Jewish experience in life or his Jewishness has something to do with the plot of the movie. And if you really think about it, despite the small number of Jews in the country, which is less than 2%, there are an enormous number of stories that are told, that have been told in cinema from 1916 through the year 2000. And this book just discusses a lot of them in a very easy, friendly, casual way. It's good popcorn reading. It's good sitting by the fireplace type reading.
And there's more than the jazz singer, is what you're saying. There's a couple more out there.
Many more. It starts with the jazz singer, and I believe the book goes all the way up to something like A Walk on the Moon with Diane Lane, which took place in the Catskill Mountains, you know, the Jewish Alps.
Oh, yeah. Well, then there'd be... I know... friend of mine who's been on this program, and I've been on his show on KFKA Radio, Gil Moon, was always talking about My Favorite Year. He always loves that movie, and certainly you have that whole flavor in there, too. So
absolutely.
We are talking with Joel Sandberg, the author of Real, R-E-E-L, Jewish, and also the author of Grandpa Had a Long One, which is the biography of his grandpa, Benny Bell. So we get to the point that Bell has... success newfound after decades in the music business. I mean, he's had little successes here and there. We neglected to mention one of my favorite Bell songs, Pincus the Peddler, which I didn't realize was a bigger hit than I imagined. I thought it was kind of this lost little song, but that sold like 250,000 copies in its time, didn't it?
Yes, the one of the estimates, yeah, exactly, did put it at 250,000 copies sold in the greater New York region. Great song.
Yeah, that's a classic number. It's, in some ways, it's even a little bit more shocking than Shaving Cream, just because it has domestic violence in it. You're not really expecting that. And
right.
I mean, I'll play Pincus in a little bit, but, you know, just this moment when he's socking his wife on the jaw, I'm like, whoa! And yet this
Which was troubling. It was a little troubling to me to hear it as a kid because I didn't understand that sort of thing. And he was not like that. He and his wife, my grandma Molly, had a, you know, 75 year long love affair, and they never even yelled at each other, let alone something like that.
Oh.
It was just a character he created.
Well, and Pink, you say character. Also, it should be known that Bell did this occasionally, where if he had a song that was a hit or caught the public imagination, he would do sequels. So he had a few different songs about Pincus later on. I have one called Pincus Went to the Mountains, and there's probably a couple of other Pincus songs. I don't know if I have them here, but you know, if you got something that works and that sells so many copies, that's why it's kind of sad to think that if you sell that many records on your own label, on your own steam, why was he in poverty? Pincus should have lifted him to a higher level, no?
Yes, should have, didn't. Same reason. The Pincus success was not really a surprise because it was already established that he had the talent to do something like that. But the follow-ups were dismal because he didn't have the business knowledge to follow it up the way it should. But Pincus came about because, as you mentioned, he did spend a little bit of time as a pushcart peddler on the streets of Brooklyn and New York to make a little money from time to time. And he didn't use the name Benny because he had already had a couple of hits, a couple of novelty hits, and he didn't want people to wonder, well, why is this guy who's a recording artist and who's been on the radio and who plays certain nightclubs, why is he a pushcart peddler?
Yeah.
So he put on a fake, as I understand it, he put on a fake beard and a fake mustache and started calling himself Pincus. Then a friend of his said, well, you know, why don't you write a song about that? And he did. And he just created a backstory, and the whole violence thing was completely fabricated. But it's a very evocative song that probably, he may have heard stories like that. For all we know, he may have heard of a peddler who did fall into a horrible marriage where it degenerated into something like that. It was one of the first true story songs, and it's very dramatic, very flavorful. More than one person has mentioned to me that if there's any song that deserves to be made into either a Broadway musical or a dramatic movie, it's the song Pincus the Peddler, and I happen to agree with them. And that's something I would love to hook up with somebody in the industry to do.
Well, if anybody from the industry is listening, yeah, I'm not exactly quite in the industry, unfortunately, but if anybody listening, Steven Spielberg, if you're out there, this would be totally up your turf, or even Spike Lee, if you're having an off day. This is Benny Bell with maybe the catchiest song he ever wrote, Pincus the Peddler. A classic from Benny Bell, Pincus the Peddler. Ah, and I punched her in the mouth. It is still a shock to hear that line. I have to say that. More shocking than shaving cream. It really is. I was like, oh my God. You know, it goes beyond funny into a realm of like pre-Lenny Bruce, like, oh, good Lord. But that's Benny Bell.
You almost don't know how to react, which is, maybe in some ways it was ahead of its time. I don't know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's still ahead of its time. If Kanye West or, all these rappers from 20 years ago, the gangster rappers, were treating women so horribly and making them into sexual objects and doing all this violence, it's like, go back to 1940 and Benny Bell singing about Pincus the Peddler socking his wife in the jaw and then kicking her down the stairs. Wow.
Yes, but who gets the last laugh? It's the wife
goes
to the authorities, and they deport him back to Russia.
Back to Petrograd, which is what St. Petersburg used to be called.
Yeah. Right. So it's not like it's not a violent song where the guy gets away with it.
Does he get violence in the Pincus the Peddler sequels? Or are those...
No, he doesn't get violent. He just gets more and more desperate to make his mark in the world. You know, they're kind of sad in a way, because I guess that somebody who really wants to do some sort of psychoanalytic discussion of the song or of all the Pincus songs might say that there's a little bit of Pincus in Benny Bell. Well, obviously, there's a little bit of Pincus in Benny Bell. The fact that he wanted to be something. He wanted to be somebody and never really became the somebody that he wanted.
Well, he started to. That was the thing. We were just about to talk again about that whole big moment in his life, many, many years into it, when Dr. Demento playing the song Shaving Cream went viral, or however viral was back in the 1970s, went to other radio stations, went to Billboard, made him some good money, and certainly vaulted him into the spotlight again. At that point, even then, he was taking like his own bad career advice, or is it just meant to be a one-hit wonder? I mean, how many songs are people really going to be listening to of that 1940s sound with the cute little novelty things in a top 40 that was either disco or Bruce Springsteen or punk?
Well, in my opinion, which is, I guess, all we can go on here, especially since I'm the one who wrote the book, I have to say that I think the answer to your question is yes, it was him again. He certainly had enough material to really make something out of it, especially since video was already out by this time. He had some songs that just loaned themselves quite nice to some visual gags that could have really been viral, or like you said, whatever was viral back then, video viral, as opposed to internet viral. Right. The song Without Pants, I mean, I could just imagine some of the ways that could have been visualized in an amazingly comic way. And he had a couple other songs like that. But, again, he did it. As a matter of fact, just to backtrack a tiny bit, during the Shaving Cream resurrection in the mid-70s, he did finally get a legitimate record company to back him. That's the Shaving Cream album came out on a label of a major record company.
Yeah, it was Vanguard, wasn't it?
It was Vanguard.
Yeah.
But even then, allegedly there was some, how to put it, not quite kosher things going on after the fact that soured him once again, probably for the 10th or 15th time in his long career, soured him against the music industry. And it just proved to him that he was right all along. You have to do it by yourself. I don't agree with that. I don't think anybody else would agree with that. but that was his philosophy.
You would have figured...
Yeah, Shaving Cream was...
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
You would have figured Vanguard, of all labels, would have been kind of on the up and up and cool, considering they dealt with the folk musicians and that realm, the Joan Baez's and, I guess, some of the Pete Seegers at that era. And you figure he would have found a good kind of label that would have protected him, but I guess it's tough, you know? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't want to say anything against Vanguard. I don't know them, and I don't know to what degree what my grandfather ended up telling us all was God's honest truth, as opposed to just his exaggeration of some of the little frustrations that he experienced along the way. So I'm not going anywhere near Vanguard.
Sure.
But the bottom line is that he wasn't happy. How he became unhappy, I don't want to even go into that. But he was not happy, and it was proof to him that he was right all along. You have to orchestrate and choreograph your own career.
Well, did Shaving Cream give him some sense of stability? I mean, if it didn't make him rich, obviously, did that at least pull him out of poverty for the rest of his very long life? I mean, did that see him through until his death, as you said, what was it, 94? 1994? Maggie died?
One of the things he always did from the very beginning was whenever he made any money on any project was he reinvested the vast majority of it into a follow-up project. Most of the time, that follow-up project didn't go anywhere. So, yes, he did very well with Shaving Cream, but he took a lot of it and he tried other things on his own, but he was not necessarily in poverty anymore, if that's what you mean.
Ah.
He survived, and he didn't have to worry day-to-day, but that said... It was nothing like it could have been, should have been, and maybe even what people thought it was. It was much less than that. At least he knew he'd eat the next day, but that was about it.
Oh,
at least he knew he'd eat the next day and that he wouldn't be kicked out of his apartment. And those are two very, very big things for somebody who grew up the way he grew up and the way my father grew up, in abject poverty. So those were two very big pluses, and that was probably enough for him if you're just talking financial stuff. If you're talking career stuff, the Shaving Cream thing was a very nice validation for him.
Oh.
He was flown out to California. He appeared at clubs out there. He was on Dr. Demento's 20th anniversary show, which was broadcast on Comedy Central, I think, or one of those cable networks. He got fan letters. There was a fan club. He was at the Bottom Line in New York City. He was at the Beacon Theater in New York City. He played on the bill with people like Weird Al Yankovic and Tiny Tim.
I will validate this, by the way. I was there, as were you. I didn't know you then, of course, but I was there at the Bottom Line on a night when Dr. Demento, it was kind of this tour thing that he put together, and among the people on the bill were Benny Bell, Weird Al Yankovic, Tiny Tim, and Bobby Boris Pickett of the Monster Mash. Who am I leaving out? There were one or two others. Who am I missing?
There were two others that were a little lesser known than all of them. Somebody with a what was it? Was it a harp person? I don't know. There were some oddball things too.
I don't remember the harpist. Yeah, but yeah, it was a wonderful night. And at that point, though, I would say that Bell was pretty old, and he was up there with the lyrics on a lyric sheet, which was helpful. And I think his wife was kind of steadying him up a little bit, helping him on the... Am I misremembering that? That he was frail?
No, that's correct, because this was 10 years already after the initial Shaving Cream resurrection.
Right.
This was like 85 now, 10 years after 75, which is when it all happened. And he was up there in age, but a trooper, a real showbiz trooper. And the show must go on. So even though his memory was going a tiny bit and he wasn't as strong as he used to be, he went up there on all the stages that he appeared in New York and on California, even if he had to have little cheat sheets in front of him. But he did it, and he was great.
He was.
And, yeah.
He
was on some cable show way towards the end of his life when he was probably 89 or something like that. Some goofball show on one of the cable networks where he recited one of his, I think it was Ikey and Mikey, one of his novelty songs, without a cheat sheet, and got about 95% of it correct up until the very end. So even if his mind was gone, he was still strong up until the very last days.
Oh, that's so, I mean, that's really good to hear. And he was probably writing more songs up until, because you can't stop when you're in that. Right. You just do it. That's what you do. You know.
Yes.
Did his wife predecease him, or did she survive him, or?
No, she predeceased him, and that was a heartbreaking thing because they were going steady, or keeping company, as they used to call it, when I think he was 16 and she was 13. That's when it started. And they weren't apart for a day after that, from 16 years old to, I guess, something like 86 years old. And when she passed away, it was the one and only time that I saw him cry in my entire life. And he waved to her like a little boy waves to somebody who's leaving. And he said, bye-bye, Molly, bye-bye. And it was just heart-rending. And as a matter of fact, it's a separate chapter in the book. So all of this is described in detail.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's just taking a moment there. But we're talking about Benny Bell with his grandson, Joel Sandberg. And you make clear early in the conversation that the reason you're the keeper of the flame rather than your dad was that because Benny was in poverty or near poverty so much of his life, your dad had to actually make a career and go out and work and support the family, and he couldn't necessarily be the record company or record plugger or, you know, go and work with the legacy. He actually had to put food on the table and did. And what did he become, an electrician or what was it?
He was a licensed electrician and a licensed plumber. He was an air conditioning and heating contractor. He ended up being owner and president of a fairly well-respected air conditioning and heating contractor on Long Island in New York.
Oh.
And that was him. That became him. He wore that hat very, very well and very, very proudly. My sister and I were raised in comfort, and we were nowhere near as rich as some other people on Long Island. We weren't rich at all. We were lower middle class, but very, very comfortable. And that was the life he chose. And you're right, I think he chose it because he didn't want to end up being anything like a Benny Bell. He loved his father very, very much, but he did not want to be like him professionally, financially.
And it's the story of that pre-baby boomer middle class and lower middle class thing where the parents struggle and work, and then the children, the next generation, has it a little easier and has a bit more choice, which I presume allowed you to be a writer and more of a journalist and a creative person, and to start to think about a life beyond the trade. Am I right on that?
That's a little tough to talk about, a little tough to think about, only because, like every good father, I guess, who owns a business, he made the offer to me to go in, you know, instead of, it could have been Jerry and Son or something like that. But it was only because, without getting spiritual at all about it, it's the writing thing is something that, I sometimes hate saying this because it just sounds so weird, it's something that I feel chose me, as opposed to me choosing it. I never wanted to do anything else, so it wasn't like I made a decision. It's just that that's what I had to do. And as you and probably many, many of your listeners know, it's an extremely difficult profession, especially freelance magazine writing.
Oh, yeah.
The rates have gone to unfathomable levels, low levels, and the policies, the unwritten rules of the trade are just reprehensible. I was hired to write two articles just a couple of months ago for a new publication in New Haven, Connecticut. The combined rate was going to be $1,900.
Mm-hmm.
I researched it, I wrote it, I submitted it, the editor loved it, but at the last minute they decided not to publish. And since there was no kill fee in the contract, I ended up not getting a dime for all that work.
Man.
Weeks and weeks of work. And that's the way it is in that industry. It's stupid.
And there's no kill fee.
You hire a contractor to build a room on your house for your mother to live in, and then she decides at the last minute not to move in, you still have to pay the contractor. He did the work. So why shouldn't you have to pay writers to do the work that they do, no matter what you end up doing with the work that they did?
That's the one thing I will say for Playboy magazine, of all things. I worked for them for a while, and I wrote some things for them. They used to pay quite well, and the rare times that they would kill one of my pieces, they would pay something like 60% or whatever it was. And I was writing very short pieces, so it wasn't like I was sweating blood on these projects. But it was just, okay, you know, I did the work, you're giving me something. Very sad that it's not making the mag, but, you know, thank you.
Absolutely.
But I know what you mean about
it. It's a skill. You should be paid for the skill, for the work that you put in and the product that you deliver, no matter what it ends up happening to that product. You did the work. You should be paid for it. But writing is not a very respected profession anymore. And that's the freelance magazine writing. I also do a lot of public relations and corporate communications writing on a freelance basis, but the economy has taken the vast majority of my clients away. They just had to eliminate their budgets for outsourced people like me.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I know, believe me, I do freelance writing myself, and it ain't fun out there. It wasn't fun when it was good, and it certainly ain't fun now. If you don't mind, let's talk a little bit more about money and financial stuff, just in the sense of who's got the copyright on all those songs, numbering maybe 300 or 400, maybe. Numbering, sorry.
The vast and crazy and convoluted world of copyrights. Well, there are a couple of ways to answer that. I'll be very, very, very brief. Here it is.
Sure.
One, a lot of them expired. Because, as you know, a lot of them were originally written in the 40s and copyrighted that. Sometimes he would renew the copyright, sometimes he wouldn't. You have to remember, copyright rates got a little bit more money each time.
Yeah.
Every couple of years they would raise the rates, and he never had a lot of money, and he had so many songs, 600 of them or something like that, that he would have had to make $100,000 a year just to renew his copyright. So those that expired. Those that were renewed, there's a few left. The copyright rules are very, very convoluted, but there's something about if they were published or renewed after a certain year, they go on for, like, I don't know, 99 or 199 years beyond the life of the songwriter.
Right.
And there are a few that are still like that. So my father was the oldest son, and I think there's some little loophole that gave him the ownership of the copyrights, and then I'm my father's only son, so they revert to me.
Not to your sister would not have any legal claim on them at all? That's kind of sad.
Well, I don't, when you get into the legalities of things,
yeah.
That's the sort of thing that if anybody ever wanted, they'd have to contract a lawyer, an attorney, to try to get to the bottom of the stuff, because nobody really knows. There's so much about copyright that just hasn't been thought out. Like this sort of thing. What if the guy dies?
Yeah.
Who does it go to if no formal contract was made? Nobody really knows for sure. I've even asked copyright people to try to explain it to me and to try to find out certain things for me, and even they weren't able to. But the bottom line is, my grandfather gave me all of his copyright papers, and I think that's a big plus in my column. He handed them to me a couple of years before he passed away, and said to me, "Joe, I want you to have these. I want you to protect the legacy. I want you to do whatever you want to do, whatever you have to do to continue the legacy after I'm gone." So to me, that's even stronger than a written contract.
But that's the reason I'm asking the question here is, if there's hundreds of songs, at least as far as publication terms, and then dozens and dozens and dozens of songs that are recorded, actual recordings by Benny Bell. Why are such a limited number of them available in a broad sense? I mean, you can get Shaving Cream, I guess, through Vanguard, and Everybody Wants My Fanny. There are a couple that were compiled by Dr. Demento on some of his compilations, but where is the Benny Bell box set? You know, what would it take for that to happen?
Somebody get in touch with me and let's work out a deal. I have many, many, many of his records. I have almost all of his albums. I have a large number of his 78s. I have just about all of his 33 and a thirds. I have all the copyright papers. I have a lot of sheet music. The records that are already out there are probably now all public domain. Anybody can probably play them on a radio and not have to pay BMI a cent for it, although there are still a few that I do get royalties for, just a
Ooh.
Couple of bucks a year, not a lot.
Okay.
So don't get scared.
Well, no, is Shaving Cream one of them? I hope so.
Shaving Cream is one of them.
Good, thank God. All right.
But I have always thought that the time is ripe for a massive Benny Bell resurrection of not just Shaving Cream, which is a great song, but certainly not one of his, how do we put it, not one of his risque classics. There are some other ones that are even better, I think, and so some that are even more infectiously goofy. And if anybody wanted to pursue some sort of massive resurrection marketing campaign, I'm up for it, and I got the stuff.
Well, have you approached, I mean, it's going to be more up to you in a sense. Have you, I mean, the first label that would come to mind would be Rhino. I mean, are they dragging their feet? Are they not interested? Are they interested?
We're working on it. That's all I can say right now.
Okay.
We're working on trying to get something going.
And what about Dr. Demento, who kind of spearheaded on some level this whole thing back in 1975? Is he at all interested, involved? Because he can get a record out, or at least he could when he was back on the regular airwaves.
He did so much to begin with. I mean,
yeah.
Always one of the biggest Benny Bell supporters, and I think he did just about as much as he could, given that he needed to spread himself around to many, many entertainers beyond Benny Bell. And now that I think, don't hold me to this, I think he's either retired or in semi-retirement, I think the time is gone for him to really be a key player and that sort of thing.
Well, yes, he's not in semi-retirement. He's doing his show every week, but he's just doing it on the internet.
Good.
Yeah, no, he's not retired. He's probably taking it a little bit easier, and he doesn't have to deal with syndication anymore. If you want to listen to the Dr. Demento show, you go to his website, and you have to pay like $2, and you can hear the weekly show. So he just changed his business model, but he's still doing his thing. So
good. Glad to hear that.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, whether he's in this day and age, it's even worth it for him or anybody to release an actual compact disc when everybody's buying their music on iTunes or something. But then again, that makes it easier for you to put together a package that would be an audio iTunes / MP3 Droid thing. Because you won't have to worry about...
The difficulty is... I'm just speaking off the top of my head. If I wanted, I can probably talk Dr. Demento into doing something with me, but that would be the Demento universe. In order to do it the way I envision it, and the way I think Benny Bell deserved it, is to have some sort of national advertising and marketing campaign to go along with it, which, as you know, costs an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't think that would be something Dr. Demento would want to go into, and maybe not even the other conventional record companies or what's left of them.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Only because the competition is so tough, the market has changed so completely. So it's almost like a catch-22. But I'm working on it, and I, you know, you never know what can happen. That's my motto in life, you never know.
Well, I would love, not that I have any money, but I would love to be involved somehow in putting this together and getting those songs out there. The famous ones, the not-so-famous ones, the some of the Yiddish klezmer stuff, and really put together, you know, a 3-disc set or something, or the equivalent of whatever that would be digitally. And just...
It would be wonderful. It would be a great idea.
Yeah.
But like I said, the only way to really make a good go out of it and to make it worth its while is to support it with some big advertising and marketing campaign, which I'm also geared up for. Professionally, I'm a marketer. I'm a public relations, marketing, communications guy, so I can really help out. I mean, the little bit that I've done on my own already has been enough to get more people interested in Benny Bell than were before I started working on it. I have CDs out there on CDBaby.com.
Oh, good,
That people can buy with a whole bunch of Benny Bell stuff on it, including one of my own, which was an update of Shaving Cream.
Are you on it? Oh, I wish I had a copy of that. Is that on YouTube or is it only on CDBaby?
CDBaby, but offline I'll talk to you about it and see what we can do.
Maybe we can play it next week if I can get a copy of it. It is noon here in northern Colorado on this January 15th, 2011. I'm Dave Lefkowitz, and we're finishing up our chat with Joel Sandberg. We've been talking about his grandpa, the subject of Sandberg's book, Grandpa Had a Long One, which you can pick up from Bear Manor Media or Amazon or Kindle or bunches of other places. Sandberg is also the author of Real Jewish, R-E-E-L, Jewish, about Jewish actors and directors and producers. Well, no, it's mostly films that have Jewish themes in them from the past century. And what else are you working on these days, aside from trying to get a full-time job? I know what that feels like.
Yeah, I'm trying to revive my marketing and communications career. I'm working on a play called The Lion and the Lamb. I'm trying to market a novel I wrote called One More Darker. Just a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, that's, again, you've got a bit of your grandfather in you. I can tell. Just you've got to have that outlet, and that's really where your heart is. And yeah, you might have to take little jobs here and there. And marketing is one of the better jobs for creative people, and press releases and stuff like that. So I wish you best of luck in both enterprises. And I'm serious, you know. I wish I had more muscle and money, but let's get the Bell songs out there even bigger.
Good idea.
They're well worth hearing. So we're going to close our chat with Joel Sandberg, of course, with another Bell tune. I don't have that many here on iTunes that I can play. I've got a few of them. Are there any that you recommend? Let me see if I've got them.
Do you have Everybody Wants My Fanny? That's one of my favorites.
That was the one I was going to close with. We are like-minded individuals, Joel Sandberg.
Thank you very much, Dave. I appreciate it.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, and best of luck.
Talk to you soon.
Here's Benny Bell.